Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I am a clinical pharmacist and a diabetes care and education specialist at the Cleveland Clinic.
And my name is Natalie Bellini. I am a nurse practitioner at R&B Medical Group.
And why we are so excited and why this episode is so special is because we are at the American Diabetes Association Scientific Sessions in New Orleans. And so we are going to have very special guests with us today. And with that, we are going to dive right into our content.
Well, we are so excited to be here with Gary Shiner today. Gary, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role in diabetes care?
It's my favorite subject. My name is Gary Shiner, and I have a clinical practice based outside of Philadelphia, and our team provides mostly virtual care, some in-person care, primarily for people with type 1 diabetes, but anybody who's on intensive insulin therapy can work with our practice. So I have a multidisciplinary team, and all of our clinicians have type 1 diabetes personally, so lends a certain degree of passion to the work, I believe. And that's about it. I mean, I do a lot of writing, several books. Think Like a Pancreas is probably the one I'm best known for.
I love that book. I really do.
Thanks. It's good for insomnia, isn't it?
It's wonderful. I recommend it.
We recommend it all the time. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So tell us, I know you've been here throughout the ADA scientific sessions. What have you seen so far that's really left an impression on you?
You know, one thing that I've been pleasantly surprised about, any session I've been to, whether it's been about pregnancy or technology or medications, one topic has come up in every one of them, and that's exercise. And as an exercise physiologist by trade, that is pleasing to me. It's nice that physical activity and exercise is gaining more attention. It seems that anything that's being developed and worked on and any clinical trials, and they're considering the physical activity components more and more. Even the product designs are considering physical activity more. So I've been very happy to see that. And you know, there was one session specifically on exercise and differences between cultures, differences between sexes, etc. But there was some good information conveyed there. Specifically about the benefits of strength training for older populations and the importance of maintaining bone density, functional capacity, muscular strength, which really ebbs as we age, and it's a cause of falls and ultimately can be fatal. So using strength training as a tool to keep people healthy as we age, I thought was great. Plus the subject of the AID systems comes up a lot, and the exercise component is still challenging. We've learned that it's, even though these systems all have override components to help avoid hypoglycemia during exercise, we've learned that you can't rely on that. Like so many things about AID systems, the user is still largely responsible for so many aspects of their glucose management, and no more so than when they exercise. It's still necessary to kind of go to those old school techniques for managing glucose during exercise, involving carb supplementation, basal insulin reduction, cutting back on bolus doses ahead of time. So that's still being reiterated with the AID systems. And I talked to a few people about things that are still in development, and with glucagon evolving, we have so many new forms of glucagon and ways to administer it, but we also have a new version from Xeris, which is a vial and syringe version of glucagon. And the concept of microdosing, this is an entirely off-label concept, but I know people like Mike Riddell is doing research on microdosing glucagon as a way to prevent lows during exercise. But there's so many applications for microdosing glucagon, for parents of young kids, people who are sleeping and a caregiver is having to raise it, and all those people who are just trying to manage their weight and don't want to be consuming extra calories. For me, I consume copious amounts of food when I'm low. It's scary how much I can eat in 10 minutes when I'm low. I should enter an eating contest when I'm low. I'd win hands down. So weight management is still important, not just for type 2s, but for type 1s also. I think the latest data is almost 40% of type 1s are either obese or grossly overweight, so it's a concern. Tirzepatide is an exciting new drug. You probably had people bring that up. But having an injectable dual functioning hormone, a GIP-GLP-1 that's acting on two unique systems that regulate appetite and insulin secretion and digestion, it's a very effective tool. You know, we're looking at 20% of body weight loss for most people, you know, once they get up to the therapeutic dose. You know, it's going to be a little challenging because it's a fairly long titration process to get up to that dose. But something tells me if patients know this is going to help them lose 20% of their body weight, they're going to be they're going to get into it, and they will follow through and do what's necessary.
So with that, I'm kind of curious, because obviously, tirzepatide was just FDA approved, but that and GLP-1 agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors are drugs technically FDA approved for type 2 diabetes. But kind of curious, if you've had experience in type 1 diabetes, and then what's been kind of your approach then to managing the insulin around these types of agents?
Oh yeah, the GLP-1 receptor agonists in particular are being used quite a bit in type 1 care. They have to be prescribed off-label, as you mentioned, but they're very effective. You talk about non-responders and responders, most people respond well to it. There are usually some side effects, some mild GI side effects, but just the ability for someone with type 1 to control their hunger and manage their food intake more effectively, you know, not only does it help with weight control, but it helps with glucose management as well. So, you know, I think it has a lot of advantages over Simlin, which, you know, obviously can also help promote weight loss, but it's complicated to use. There's a lot of adjustments to the insulin that have to take place. The adjustments with the GLP-1 receptor agonists are modest at best. Usually we're just talking about slight reductions in bolus insulin, and it's probably related more to glucagon suppression than changes in food intake, because most of the people we work with are on insulin to carb ratios anyway. So they're eating less, they naturally take a little bit less bolus insulin. But I think ultimately, even though, you know, tirzepatide is just approved for type 2, it's going to find its way into people with type 1. It's a once weekly, you know, similar to the ones we use now. And it looks as though the weight loss effect is that much greater. You know, for people who don't want to do the math, 20% weight loss for somebody who's 200 pounds, that's 40 pounds.
Yeah.
40 pounds, right. That's phenomenal. You know, it's nice to see.
That is phenomenal. And the other side of that is, of course, that the cardiovascular risk reduction with the weight loss alone. There are no cardiovascular outcome studies yet with the tirzepatide, but we do know that there is risk relation to weight loss and all by itself. So I think you're right. It is very exciting. Can you talk to us a little bit about SGLT2 inhibitor use with your type 1 population? Because I know you also do that, and what you're using now for protocols and euglycemic PKA. Can you give us a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, with the SGLT2 inhibitors, you can also induce weight loss through glycosuria. You can improve postprandial glucose a little bit as well due to the glycosuria, but there is that inherent increased risk of ketoacidosis when you use them. So we educate our patients about the advantages, the potential disadvantages, and then they can have an intelligent conversation with their prescriber and figure out the best approach. You know, for those who ultimately get the prescription and begin using it, you know, we provide a detailed list of kind of policies they need to follow as far as maintaining hydration, maintaining adequate carb intake. You know, very low carb intake also is going to predispose them to DKA. And also about routine ketone testing when glucose levels are even modestly elevated. And in some cases, for those who really want to keep the carb intake down, we have them doing daily ketone checks to make sure they're on track. And I just learned at the meeting that Abbott is working on a continuous ketone monitor, which would integrate with a continuous glucose sensor in the same little sensor. So that may open the door for safer and more widespread use of SGLT2s in people with type 1.
Yeah, Yeah, that is super exciting. So kind of speaking of that and new technology coming out, curious if you got a chance to walk through the expo and what anything that you're really excited about that you've seen here.
I'm kidding. It's my second favorite thing about these conferences is hitting the exhibit floor and seeing, you know, what the latest is. And since it's been a few years since we've had this conference, there have been some, you know, major leaps. In the continuous glucose monitor space is where we're seeing the most improvement, the most change, and pretty much every CGM company has new iterations of their products, either just launching now, recently launched, or going to be launching shortly. Abbott just got approval for the Libre 3. The accuracy data looks good. The form factor, it looks like a tiddlywink, if you remember what those little plastic things are. It's tiny, tiny. And you know, they've got a very good price point for these things. You know, they just have to integrate. They have to get this system compatible with other software for downloading and other devices for AID technology. Yeah, but they got a nice product. Dexcom is hopefully going to be launching their G7 later this summer. I mean, G6 is a wildly popular system, and G7 is just taking it to another level in terms of just ease of use, functionality, and accuracy. So that's something to look forward to. And they've already got the integration with everything out there, which is wonderful. You know, Eversense has their six-month implanted sensor approval. And, you know, hopefully with the pandemic clearing up and people going for more in-person care, that'll start to pick up again a little bit. That was put on like a major halt because people weren't going in person for their care and they needed implanted in the office by their clinician. So hopefully we'll see that sometime soon as well. The other thing I really enjoyed yesterday, I had a chance to be on a panel with Natalie and talking about the concept of time in range. And it's true, time in range is a much better metric for assessing glucose quality than A1C. We learn a lot more from that than we can from A1C. But the beauty of this panel was the idea was we can't stop there because we can do even better. What we do with the data, how we respond to it is very important. Natalie really focused on that. And then Earl Hirsch presented a whole new metric for going beyond just the time in range, looking at the time below range and how often someone was hitting extreme highs and lows and coming up with one number, one metric to score that. And it's really sort of, I call it a red flag measure of, is this person in trouble and do we need to dig in deeper, or are they doing well and we don't have to be overly concerned? So even though time in range is a valuable tool, we're going to see better and more applicable and meaningful metrics than even that. So that's an exciting thing for me. I'm kind of a, you know, data junkie, so that kind of numerology I find appealing.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Excellent.
Yeah, I remember I asked him the question at the end of the panel about time in tighter range. So like we use the time in range 70 to 180, which has been the accepted standard. But I know, like, for example, some of the tirzepatide studies, they actually looked at that time in tighter range of 70 to 140. Mm-hmm. And when you've got these newer agents and you don't have this risk of hypoglycemia in people with type 2 diabetes, can we aim for the 70 to 140 and really try to optimize the time there? So it's kind of, it's a super interesting.
Why shouldn't we aim for I love his GDR, but if he had covered his actual topic, that's another story. Yeah, someone with type 2 who's not at risk of hypoglycemia, we shouldn't accept glucoses in the 160-180 range. That's not appropriate. So yeah, we should aim for tighter targets where it's appropriate and where it's allowable. And there's so many, you know, special populations where the target ranges don't fit in nice and neatly with the standard ADA ACE recommendations. I believe in individualization of the targets and also individualizing the goal. You know, 70% is a goal that's good for some people, but not everybody. You take somebody who's already 78% in range and say, no, the goal's 70, we gotta lower it. Or somebody who's 20% in range, the goal's not 70, maybe it's 30. You know, we've gotta do things in small increments. So I think that's an important aspect of when we talk about time and range, is what are realistic goals?
Right, the individualization. And I have been really happy to see that that has been a common theme here, about individualizing and not just like one blanket thing for all.
Yeah.
I also think that there is something to be said for not treat to fail. So what we've done in the past is we put someone on metformin and we wait till their A1C starts to climb, and then we put someone on the next drugs and we wait for their A1C to climb. And now we say things like, wait a minute, your mother died early of cardiovascular disease, your father had 3 stents before he was 60, let's treat you like you have cardiovascular disease because you also have diabetes.
Yeah.
And you probably do. We don't even need to do the testing.
Yeah.
Let's treat to what we should be doing. So I think that tighter range is really acceptable to lots of those patients that we see. Let's address kidney function when you start to spill protein. Let's address cardiovascular disease based on your risk, relative risk reduction, and what your family history looks like now.
Yeah, and why do we need a 3-month lag time or a 6-month lag time? We can look at sensor data within a few weeks and get an idea of whether something's working or not.
Exactly.
And why expose them to uncontrolled glucose for years unnecessarily during that whole titration process? As diabetes care and education specialists, I think we really champion the individualization part of things. So seeing more of our colleagues speaking at this meeting and having an influence on what's going on, it's only good.
I've been really happy to see that. It's been a diverse group of speakers.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm grateful, because not all conferences we know are that way with the diversity of speakers. So kind of, we talked about a lot of stuff. So kind of just in closing, last question we want to ask you is, I guess, what's your, I guess, major key takeaway from this conference, or one kind of action step you think everyone should take from attending here?
Tirzepatide is a medication that I think is going to have a lot of applications, certainly in the type 2 space, but also in the type 1 space, for patients who have weight control issues, appetite issues, etc. I wouldn't call it a magical medication, but I'd say it's far and away better than anything we've had to this point for weight loss purposes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Gary. I hope you have a great rest of the meeting, and thanks for spending some time with us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. It's great seeing you both.